Scott?
On 18th August 76 at Cambridge. Now, were you an undergraduate at Cambridge?
No, I was in Birmingham. Yes.
I see. In physics?
Yes.
And when did you arrive with the Cambridge Radio Group?
That would be autumn 57.
And when a new student arrives in the radio group, then how is it determined what you're going to do? What happened then?
At that time, the number of programs was rather smaller, and usually one worked for a short length of time doing general dog's body jobs. And then either one would show an interest in a particular field, or one particular part of the work would obviously need a new student. Mm-hmm. There was only one other student who came at the same time as myself, so it was fairly simple to decide what was to be done.
And what, in fact, did you work on?
Well, this was the 4C aerial, which had just been mechanically built, and it was just starting to make observations.
So I think the 3C data had just been finished.
That had been completely finished.
But not the analysis.
No, the analysis would have been completed.
But already the 4C aerial was beginning to be built.
That's right, and that was on a new site, of course, so that I never worked at the old site.
I see. And what sort of jobs needed to be done? Can you just give me a feel for...
Well, mainly, I suppose, I was connected with the receivers, improving the receivers, and just generally sorting out the snags in that one always gets in a new, totally new aerial system.
What were some of those snags that you had, in fact?
Well, it's difficult to remember this length. It was this new technique of also apposite synthesis and the problems about the phase stability and getting calibrations around tuning phase, path compensation cables, an area which we hadn't had to bother about before, and just some general problems of keeping preamplifiers working out in the field and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm. Was there any doubt in the group's mind that the method would not work if you got over the technical difficulties?
Well, I think one knew the method would work in to some extent. I think it worked much better than one had ever thought.
Really?
It was possibly likely to, at least when one wasn't sure it was going to work anything like as well as it did. I believe it is true. I mean, having spoken with people afterwards, that even at that stage there had been a suggestion of embarking on a much more ambitious system. And the reason for not doing that was because it wasn't felt that one had proved the technique sufficiently of that sort.
And when you say more ambitious, what do you mean?
Well, possibly even beginning to think of a two-dimensional synthesis instead of a one-dimensional synthesis. I think that very early experiments have been done on some form, a sort of earth rotation synthesis, even at that stage.
What work would that be? I'm not sure I'm familiar.
This was Jan Hobom, I think, had done observations over a range of hour angles, showing that you can get built up in a two-dimensional aperture.
That's right.
Which is even really almost before I got there.
And that was with phases also?
Yes.
He didn't assume symmetry or anything?
Oh, no. Right. This is a proper synthesis.
Right.
Although I think it's true that he used the north-south baseline, which isn't in fact the most sensible one to use, in fact.
For earth rotation,
yes.
Yeah. So, the first publication you have is in 1961, first results of radio star observations using the method of apposite synthesis. And was this essentially the first bit of the 4C survey?
Yes, I think that's right. The first area to be observed in a normal conservative way, I think, was the strip around the zenith, which avoided problems about path compensation cables, because as you move your aerial along the level track, the path stayed constant at the zenith.
Right.
And that seemed a sensible one to do. And I think the next strip is one at 42 degrees declination. I think it's right that it was those two strips which were essentially included in this paper.
And were there any surprises from the results that you got from this?
Well, as I say, but it did work. The system did seem to work very well. I suppose surprised in a sense not. In the sense that we had already said something about the number flux density count from the CC survey.
Right.
But of course this survey tended to confirm that, which was the result of the next paper. The results included in the next paper.
Which is
the number flux density.
Scott and Ryle, the number flux density relation. Yes. And what was the basic results from that?
Well, this that said on the basis of the interferometer counts, that it gave a slope of 1.8 for the minus 1.8 for the log n log s curve, which is in the same sort of direction as the previous CC result. Not quite as steep, but very similar.
Was anyone really worried about the 3C counts, or was it just a matter of, well, at least to the outside world, 2C had been wrong and 3C maybe was right, but that's sort of one-to-one, and you'd like to...
Well, I think most people would have thought that the CC survey was a much more conservative survey than 2C, and one sort of learned the lesson there. And I think one would have thought that, broadly speaking, it couldn't be greatly in error, and so certainly not sufficient in error to be compatible with the first results in Little's Cross, for example, mm-hmm. which is a great discrepancy.
3C you're talking about now.
Yes, that's right.
So was the 4C... so you had 3C versus the Mills results, and I guess he wanted to do it in an entirely different way and hopefully come up with something that would be consistent
that's
with
right.
3C
and
again.
Yes. And also, of course, it was just extending the flux density range, which makes the whole thing much, the statistics are much better.
Right.
That you have comparable statistics, comparable number of sources, in both the high flux density and the low flux density range. Which should give you a good idea of the slope.
Did the controversy with Mills over the MSH survey continue right until the mid-60s? I mean, in the...
I was never sure to how... I don't know, there was a lot of correspondence with it or chance of discussion. I suspect it's been the more the sort of cosmologists and the people who were wanting to use these results who were most, as it were, worried by the apparent discrepancy. But I'm not sure that at what stage the Australian group had begun to sort of see that there might be some errors in say, blending the sources mm-hmm. in their survey.
I think Edge and Moke say that when Scheuer went to Australia, as a matter of fact, and worked with the Parks fish, that this sort of became the point where the resolution came about that indeed there were some inadequacies.
That's
in
right.
Mills' survey.
Yes, and then we had, and as we covered more sky, and then certainly the area that overlapped, of course, which is quite small in the southern declinations, one could begin to see possibly how where the discrepancy arose.
Now, when did you get your degree through here?
I think it was actually written up quite at the end of the fourth year. Certainly not before, but the income tax had a peculiar quirk that because as long as you were a full-time student, you didn't pay any tax, and there was no great incentive, therefore, to write up. I had a college research fellowship,
and
it lasted 2 years.
And it was basically on the technique of aperture synthesis?
Yes, it was specifically the results of the force of air and the login of this sort of thing.
Now, I see the next two things here are answering other people's interpretations, Hanbury Brown's and Shiyama's interpretations of log n, log s. Can you tell me what the nature of that did?
Well, so I think that Hanbury Brown I'm not so sure about, but I would imagine that they were both of them essentially local hypotheses. Certainly, I think both of them would have postulated two classes of source. The Sharma one was more saying it was just a low power class of source which had a local inhomogeneity, which would be sensible if the sources were compatible nearby. And
Sharma was still an advocate of steady state at that time.
Oh, certainly,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was really, the papers would point out that this couldn't really be squared with the evidence about isotopy, for example. And you know, the statistics, you had to distort the identifications as well. It is an embarrassment that you had identified as large a proportion of the sources if some of them were meant to be the mm-hmm. truly sort of invisible low power.
And the isotropy argument was that they couldn't be much thicker than the galactic disk, and then you would be able to see. I mean, if they had a distribution.
It's just that if there was a local hole, then it's a bit unreasonable to suppose you were bang in the middle of it.
Oh, I see what you're
therefore saying that supposing one was a third of the way from the centre of it, perhaps, then you could predict how much anisotropy there would be in the source plane.
Now, was Hanbury Brown a believer in. Believer. It's a strong word. Advocating the steady state also, or was it just that he.
That, quite honestly, I'm not sure. I suppose he must have had a slight deflection towards it if he was putting forward theories to explain away source counts. I'm not even sure at that stage whether he was still working in this country or.
He was in Australia.
Yes. Then. Well, it may be then he was more concerned with the discrepancy between the North Cross and. Cambridge results.
But they are two distinct questions, though, the nature of the cosmology and whether the radio sources
that's
are
right.
Local or not.
Yes, one should be a purely observational fact, that's what the other one is.
But like you say, they do get mixed up somewhat. Maybe I should ask you, coming in the middle of the real 2C MSH controversy, did you very quickly become wrapped up in this? Was that the motivation for the 4C survey? Was more or less to show that this was right and so forth? I mean, was that?
Oh no, I don't think so. I mean, the 4C survey meant much fainter in flux than the Mills survey. I certainly had 2C. And it was just basically to find out what the log n log s slope was. Obviously, one would hope that it would be more or less consistent with the 2C survey.
But you think that even if there had been no disagreements, that the program would have proceeded along?
Oh, absolutely. The other thing is, of course, getting more accurate positions to enable the kind of implications to be carried out, and so on.
Right.
Another very important part of it.
Yeah, this was just about the time, like you say, when they were beginning to be a few tens instead of just a few.
That's right.
Coming in.
Certainly, the brighter source is a really significant proportion were then identified.
Right. And that was something that Ryle did not have in the Beccarian lecture, if I remember correctly. There were only a very few identifications.
That's
58.
I've seen no autoglobulins really voted at all. I mean, it was purely other sort of radio arguments.
Right. Right, most of it was. But he did have a table of the known identifications.
Yes,
and
yes,
the total was no more than 10.
No, yes, yes.
Well, let's see. No, apparently you worked somewhat with Hewish's group on interplanetary simulations.
Well, the whole sort of connection with interplanetary simulation and then later of pulsars was really that this was the aerial, which was this aerial, the 4C aerial was used in investigating these things. In the case of interplanetary simulation, that arose directly from a survey of accurate source positions, which was being carried out with the 4C aerial. There had been a series of surveys where Bruce Elsmore had done accurate positions of 50 odd sources.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was published in the revised, in the original CC catalogue. Which was done by accurate time measurements with the 4C aerial. And then a second survey of accurate source position, mainly for identifications, was done using the 4C aerial. And for this purpose, the chart was run fast, because all the time was done from the chart. So you'd be running a chart of several feet a minute.
I see.
And it was then that one noticed these rapid fluctuations. I mean, very large modulation. I'm getting on for 100% on a few sources.
Hmm.
Only a few sources did it, and they did it absolutely consistently every day you looked at them. And it was then from that that the discovery of that interplanetary simulation arose.
I haven't talked to Hewish yet, but who was it that came up with the idea that sort of extend the ionosphere theory to the interplanetary medium?
This is a slightly confused area, I think. Tony certainly worked it out, Tony Hirsch. I think, I mean, numerically, I mean, that's to say with actual sensible numbers to show that it really was possible. At the time, Phil Williams, who was working with the 38 megacycle area, also, I think, had the idea that this could be due to independent disintegration. Mm. But I suspect just didn't, as it were, show it in the same
biggest way.
Partly, of course, because Tony Hirsch had been working on the Sogona.
Sure.
And therefore, for him, it was a fairly simple extrapolation
to work
this out, whereas other people weren't quite so familiar with it.
He had all the techniques.
The numbers, right, and just electron densities, what happened.
Now, was this immediately realized that this would be a powerful technique for source sizes?
I think so. The obvious question, of course, was why some did it and some didn't. And everyone immediately said that was because of the difference in angular size. And, I mean, for those observations, I mean, the angular size is immediately interesting.
Right.
It was less than the second part.
Right. And this was pre-VLB in my days.
Yeah.
Well, but then Jodl...
I'm not even sure that any of the Jodl data...
That was just beginning to come along.
It might,
but not to 1 arc second, though.
I think it is true that this would be putting the sort of sizes below what.
Yeah. Maybe Jodl was a bit better, but in any case, it would be much simpler to organize than an LBI experiment. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So it came about because of wanting to have accurate timing.
Oh yes, certainly. Just because the chart was running fast enough to actually be able to see. Otherwise, one might well have said this was atmospheric fluctuations or noise or bursts of interference if we were looking at a slow chart, I think. But the other thing was, I mean, because one knew one was running the chart fairly fast, one had been working with a reasonably short time constant, 1 or 2 seconds.
Right.
So that you would actually observe this fluctuation.
Now, is the amplitude of them such that they could have been discovered in the mid-50s or something, if anyone had done a similar experiment?
With a similar experiment, observing, say, 1 second time constant, and looking at having the chart running fast enough, anybody would have seen them, I think.
Hmm.
I think the point would be that there couldn't be so many telescopes which would have sufficient signal to noise to see the source adequately with that time constant.
That's right, so you need a large collecting area also, yeah. But something like the Mills Cross, for example.
Yes, I would.
Would have had enough collecting area.
Surely, I would think so, yes. Yeah. I mean, that's the noise about the signal.
Okay, well, the final thing that I'd like to hear you say something about is the pulsar discovery and so forth, which you were involved in the first publication, so you must have been one of the main people working on it.
Yes, well, this again was really that the fourth year was fairly well adapted to actually investigating these objects and recording them, and since I've always been fairly closely involved with the instrumental side and instrumentation and receivers and recording and so on, I could fairly easily adapt things to get data.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, the 4CL at that stage had been converted so that it could scan in right ascension, track a source in right ascension. This is for looking at occultations of radio sources, lunar occultations of radio sources. So that we could, in fact, record these pulsars for periods of half an hour or so. And this, of course, made it much easier to get some estimate of the accuracy in the periodicity of the pulses for a long period of time.
But no, it wasn't discovered with the 4CR, though. It was
certainly not. It was with the 4-acre, that's right.
Right.
But of course, that could only see the thing for 4 minutes a day, whatever it was, to go through the beam. And the sensitivity, I guess, would be comparable of the two instruments for looking at the pulsar.
Mm-hmm.
It always seemed that the early observations we made with the 4CL were more striking than any that we ever subsequently obtained, really.